continue the Shiur in Gemara. The Gemara says that the people of a certain city called Simunya came to Rebbe. Again, the word Rebbe in Gemara means Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the chief rabbi of the Sanhedrin, the one who compiled the Mishnah, and also known as Rabbeinu HaKadosh. They came to Rabbeinu HaKadosh and they said to him, "We want you to give us from among your students one to be our leader, a rabbi of our city. He should be our rabbi, he should serve as judge, should serve as chazan, should serve as teacher for children, as lecturer, and in addition, to supply all our needs." Well, this is the attitude that people take today. We hire a rabbi, he's got to be a social director, a youth director, a collector, a shemesh, cleaner, everything. Fine, this is an attitude towards rabbis. Notice that this existed then too. And then he gave them Rabbi Levi Bar Sisi. So Levi Bar Sisi is one of his better students, great tzaddik, big chacham. They took him home, his prize package, and they made special knis with a big platform on the front, the platform, the bima, where the rabbi sits up on a chair, a higher chair, this kavod. It's a great kavod. Of course, it looks like kavod, but the purpose for it is not usually for kavod. The purpose is that the committee members, directors, can look at this rabbi on top and say, "We own him. He's ours. We control him. We can tell him what to do. He can't tell us what to do." We could direct his his lectures, and we give him orders. After he was there for a short while, they came to him and said, "We have a she'ela to ask you, to test you. The committee is going to test you. What is the law of chalitza?" Reference to chalitza. Chalitza means, as we have learned previously, that if a woman is married and her husband dies, she has no children, and she is called a yivameh, which means that her dead husband's brother now has to give her yibum, meaning he must marry her. If he refuses, she is still considered married to him until she gets a type of divorce called chalitza. Chalitza means special ritual where they have a group of chachamim witnessing, where he stands facing her wearing a special type of shoe, and she unlaces this shoe, she removes the shoe, and then she spits out on the ground in front of him, and she says, "This is what we think of a person who refuses to rebuild, to uphold the name of a Jew. Because if he would marry her, automatically the child will be named after his dead brother, her dead husband, and it would perpetuate his name. Since he refuses to marry her, that means that his name is now gone." So this is called chalitza, a special ritual. There's no other type of divorce possible. The yivama has to have chalitza in order to become free to marry others. Now, the question they asked Rabbi Levi was, first, what if this woman has no arms? How does she go about unlacing the shoe? He could not answer this question. Levi could not answer this question. So we have a second question. What if when she expectorates, that means when she spits out blood instead of saliva, is it considered having accomplished this act? Again, he could not answer. So the committee said, perhaps he doesn't know deep Hebrew laws. But let's ask him a simple question in Darush. I got that. So I asked him, what about this pasuk in Daniel, where the pasuk tells us that a malach, the angel of heaven, was speaking to Daniel. He said to Daniel, I will tell you about this seal written in a writing of emet, of truth. Our question is, in a writing of truth, is there such a thing as a writing that is not truth? Speaking about a writing from heaven, why do you say a ketav of truth? Again, he could not answer. The Gemara says they came to Rabbeinu HaKadosh, and they very angrily they said, this is what you gave us as our rabbi? He doesn't know anything. Rabbeinu HaKadosh said, impossible. I guarantee you that I gave you someone who is as great as I am. At least he's no less than I am. He knows as much as I do. He said, let's see. So he sent for Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Levi came. Rabbeinu HaKadosh asked him, tell me, what's the law if they give a man? This woman doesn't have any arms. What does she remove his shoe with? The lady answered, the law is, she must remove with her teeth. She said to them, see, he does know it. Next question. What if she spits out blood instead of saliva? He answered, well, because she's still kasher, because we say that it's impossible there should be no drop of saliva in there. Which means there must be saliva too, therefore it's kasher. This is a secret reason why it has to be just so. Just the reason for her spitting out saliva in front of him, this is all a symbol of the zera, the seed which was born, the child which is supposed to be born, now it's wasted. So he said to him, now, next question, what is this statement, Asuk, which says that Malach said to Daniel, I will tell you about the seal written in truth. Is there one that is not truth? So he answered, this refers to a decree from heaven, a harsh decree, and this is called truth when it's sealed, because we say that the seal of Hashem is emet, truth. If this is sealed, there's no way to remove this harsh decree. If the seal in heaven is not put down, then it could be, the Zedah could be removed. This seal means when Hashem Kaviyachol swears. Hashem swears that this decree will take place, and there's no way to undo it. So, Rabbeinu HaKadosh asked Rabbi Levi, why didn't you answer these questions when they placed it before you? So he said, how could I? They placed me on a platform way up, all that kavod, all these people in front of me, so much honor, that the minister says that when a person becomes conceited, filled with haughtiness, first thing that happens, as the conceit goes to his head, the brains leave. So there's a pasuk which says, "Im nevelta v'itnase, zavota yad l'peh." If you lower yourself, if you are lowered in knowledge of Torah, it's pitnase, because you became haughty. Haughtiness brought you to a degradation. And if you find that, if you plan, your thoughts are for the sake of kavod, semota means you plan, desire this kavod, and yad l'peh, hand to mouth. That means when you're asking, you place your hand in front of your mouth, embarrassedly, you cannot answer the question. Now, the Gemara says that, referring back to this item, if there is a vow Hashem swears, then the Gezeirah, this decree, must remain. Where do we find that? Hashem said to, when Eli, the Kohen Gadol, ruled over the Jews, and his children were very evil, Hashem became angered, and he spoke to Shmuel the prophet for the first time. While Shmuel the prophet was serving Eli, he was a young boy, Hashem called his name. Shmuel, Shmuel. He heard his name being called, so he ran to Eli to ask what he wanted. Elisa, I didn't call you. Go back to sleep. Again, he heard his name being called, and Eli understood. The third time Eli understood, this must be Hashem calling him. And then he said, if you hear your name being called again, rise immediately and say, Hineni, Hashem, I am listening, I'm ready. He went back, and he heard his name being called. He stood up and he said, Hashem, your servant is ready, listening. Hashem said to Shmuel the prophet, first time, know that I'm going to bring destruction upon the house of Eli the Kohen Gadol. His children, his descendants will be wiped out, and nothing will forgive this sin. No sacrifice in the world will ever have this sin erased. This Hashem swears about the family of Eli, family and descendants of Eli. Death will come upon them, and no sacrifice in the world will erase it. So we see from here, this held true. All the descendants of Eli died young, or in general died, because of this Gezeirah of Hashem with the vow. Agav, by the way, for those who are interested, there's a story in the Sipurei Maasiyot of Rabbeinu Zal, the story of the seven beggars. And there, Rabbeinu Zal speaks about the ventriloquism in a spiritual sense. What is ventriloquism? That means a person could speak here, and his voice is heard a distance away, which means a voice that leaps over a barrier and comes out in a different spot. This is in the physical sense. The spiritual sense, you have that too. And then Rabbeinu Zal brings as a simple example the case of the voice of Hashem speaking to Shmuel the prophet, where Eli was close to the Hechal. He was between Shmuel and the Hechal. And the voice leaped over Eli, did not reach Eli, it reached to Shmuel the prophet. That's just, by the way, this is just an incentive for you to read that story to the Rabbeinu Zal. Now the Gemara says, two rabbis say, one Rabbi says that when this pasuk says Hashem swore that the sins of Eli will not be forgiven with all the sacrifices in the world, that's true. But it will be forgiven through the mitzvah of Torah. If the family of Eli learn Torah, this decree of death will be removed. They'll be able to live. Abaye said, I say that this pasuk means that if they have sacrifices, it will not suffice. They will die. But if they give tzedakah, milut chasadim, this will prolong their lives. Even as these two rabbis, Rabbi and Abaye, both were descendants of Eli. And knowing that this decree of death was upon the family of Eli, Rabbi studied Torah very diligently, and he lived to the age of 40. Abaye, who studied Torah and also concerned himself with the giving of tzedakah, gmilut chasadim, lived to the age of 60. What is the reason for this exact age? Mr. Mishneh says that this world exists on, this world stands on three pillars. This world exists because of three items that support the world. One is the study of Torah. The second pillar is Avodah, which means sacrifices in the Holy Temple. Today we haven't got that in its place. Today we have prayers, tefillah. The third is Milut Chasadim, giving charity and helping others. Now, since the pillar of sacrifices cannot help, Hashem swore this sacrifice cannot help for Eli, the other two could. When does heaven punish a person, a child? Not at the age of 13. Does a boy become responsible? That's in the earthly court. The heavenly court becomes responsible at the age of 20. So until 20, he's safe from heaven. And therefore, since until 20 he has the additional 20 years he gets for learning Torah, which Rabbah spoke about. Abaye, who added also the third pillar, had the age of 60. Lived to the age of 60. However, a very vital question is, a very important question, revolving around this topic is why the case we find that there was a family in Yerushalayim who died, the people in the family died at the age of 18. This was sort of a plague that broke out in their family. They came and reported this to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the chief rabbi, and he said to them, undoubtedly you must be from the family of Eli, therefore you have this curse. So I advise you, go study Torah and you will live. They went and studied Torah and this plague stopped. They lived longer, and they called this family of Rabbi Yochanan, because he gave them life. They gave this whole family a name, Rabbi Yochanan's family. Here the question is, Rabbi Yochanan surely knew about these statements of Rabba and Abaye. In fact, the Gemara says, Gemara Sukkah, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was one of the students of Hillel. What was his greatness? He knew the language of the Shadi, the language of the trees. He knew all these statements and questions of Abaye and Abba of many generations later. So surely he knew his statements. Knowing this, why did he say to this family, go study Torah? Why didn't he say, go give charity, you'll live that much longer? The answer is that, a delicate answer, the answer is this family, part of the family were dying. Only part of them. And studying this, he found that only the poor people in that family were dying. The rich ones lived. Why? Because the rich ones were giving a lot of charity, they remained alive. The poor ones wished they could give charity, but they couldn't afford it. They were dying. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said to them, you cannot give charity. You cannot give a lot to that God to redeem yourselves. But you too have a means of saving yourselves, and that's through the study of Torah. And therefore, to these people, he said, even though you cannot give to that God which saves from death, which can prolong your life, but you could study Torah, which is a means of escaping the Gizeda decree of Hashem against the family of Eli. The Gemara says, when a person says Amidah, he says the Shmoneh Esrei, and how is he supposed to stand? How does he pray to Hashem? What direction does he, do his eyes face? One rabbi says, he must hold his head down. Of course, the eyes must be closed. Or looking into the Siddur, his eyes should look downwards. Down means to the ground, to the ground of Eretz Yisrael. The second rabbi says his eyes should be raised upwards to heaven. You're praying to Hashem, look up to heaven. So, even this is Rabbi Yishmael, but Rabbi Yossi came by. Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yossi, was one of the elders of that time. And while they were discussing this law, he said to them, what are you speaking about? They said, reference to selling. So he said, my father, Rabbi Yossi, said that one who prays should keep his eyes down, look down, and his heart he should raise to heaven. Raise your heart to heaven and keep your eyes down. In order that you can fulfill both of these, eyes to heaven and eyes to the ground. As the eyes of the heart to heaven, heavenwards, the eyes physicalized downwards. The question, of course, the Gemara says elsewhere that the person should always face towards Yerushalayim, no matter wherever he is. The answer is that means his face should be turned that way. They were speaking about the face, direction he faces. But the eyes, which direction do the eyes face, either up or down? This is the topic we just dealt with. First, we mentioned this before, that if a person is selling in a place where the Heichal is not towards the east, then it is more important that his face is turned towards the east than to be turned towards the Heichal. So if it's embarrassing to face in a different direction than the entire Knis, you stand the same as the others facing the Heichal, your body facing the Heichal, and turn your head towards the east. Unless, of course, the Heichal is towards the west, then it's impossible. Turn as much toward the south as possible. The Gemara says that while these rabbis were speaking, suddenly they were in the yeshiva, entering the yeshiva, and just then Rabbeinu HaKadosh came in. He was the chief rabbi. And as he came in, they quickly rushed to their seat, and they sat down very quickly. Rabbi Yishmael Ben Yossi was very heavy, and he walked very slowly. Bein HaKadosh was in his place already, ready to start lecturing, and here he walked past the people who were sitting. He was holding up everything. Bein HaKadosh had one who stood by his side to serve him. His name was Abden. Abden, the Yerushalmi says, is really the Abba Yudan, a short Abden. Abden called out very arrogantly to Rabbi Yishmael Ben Yossi, "Who is this person who dares to walk over the heads of the students of the yeshiva?" As they were all sitting on the ground, he was walking, looked like walking over them. In other words, you should have been seated in your place when the rabbi was in there already. So he said, "I am Rabbi Yishmael Ben Yossi. I came to learn Torah from the mouth of Rabbi, the Bein HaKadosh." So Abdan very sarcastically called back, "Are you fit to learn Torah from the mouth of Bein HaKadosh?" He answered, "Well, was Moshe Rabbeinu fit to learn Torah from the mouth of Hashem, Kaviyachol? If he did, I can learn Torah from the Bein HaKadosh." So Abdan called out to him, "Are you Moshe Rabbeinu?" So Yishmael called out, "Is your rabbi Hashem?" The Gemara says this was a sharp dig at the Bein HaKadosh, who got this dig, this punishment, because of the fact that he did not inject a word to the offender of Yishmael of Yossi at the time. Because he remained silent, therefore he got this insult. What was the insult? He said, "Is your rabbi Hashem, not mine?" Which was, of course, a sharp retort against the Bein HaKadosh. At that moment, a Yevameh came before the Bein HaKadosh to ask for the to arrange for Chalitza. She wanted to get the ritual done, divorce her from her husband's dead husband's brother. The Bein HaKadosh said to Abdan, "Go outside, check with her, find out if she's 12 years old. She's under 12, then she cannot have this mitzvah performed yet." So Rabbi Yishmael Ben Yossi said, as Abdan walked out, he said to the Bein HaKadosh, "My father Rabbi Yossi said that even if she's under 12, she can still have chalitza, still have this ritual." Bein HaKadosh called out to Abdan, "Come back. This elder rabbi Rabbi Yossi already stated the halacha. We don't have to go into this investigation of her age." As Abdan started to come back, Rabbi Yishmael Ben Yossi called out to him and said, "Those that are needed in the yeshiva, those whose knowledge is needed, they can step over the heads of the students. But one who is not needed, how does he dare to step over the heads of the students?" So Rabbi called out to Abdan, "Sit down right where you are. Stop walking." At that second, the Gemara says, Abdan was stricken with leprosy and his children died. This was a penalty, leprosy and children dying, a penalty for Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara generally means slander, but it means to speak with arrogance against the great Tzaddik. He was punished immediately for this, his sin. So the Gemara says, Baruch Hashem, how lucky Abdan was, how fortunate he was, that he was punished immediately in this world rather than having to go to Olam Haba and there lose Gan Eden and there go to Gehinom. How fortunate he is. This of course carries out that point we mentioned time and again about the fact that 1 second of Gehinom is worse than all the suffering in this world. And this sounds so horrible, leprosy, his children dying, and yet this is small. It's fortunate for a person to have that rather than to have to go through Chas V'Shalom Gehinom. The Gemara says there are three things that a person should strive for, should select wherever possible. One is Chalitza. That means that if the brother dies and the husband of this wife dies, living brother has a choice now, either to make Yibum, meaning to marry his brother's wife, or to give her chalitza, this divorce by removing the shoe, that whole ritual. Which is better? The Yibum says, always prefer chalitza. Though it's a mitzvah to marry her, and to retain the name, the whole mitzvah is to retain the name of the dead brother, still, the best thing is chalitza. Why? Because the Yibum says, nobody today is in that madrega, that level, where he can say that his kavanah, his intention of marrying this woman, is for the sake of the mitzvah of keeping up the name of his brother, retaining a dead brother's name. Person does it because he wants her for beauty, for money, for any other reason. And if not, he can reject her. He can give a chalitza, divorce. So therefore, since there's nobody today who's that pure, then a person should always take the chalitza, because even if he thinks that he's doing it for the sake of the mitzvah, if he studies himself deeply, he'll find that subconsciously he has a different motive. So rather than, if he has a different motive, of course, then there's a very big danger. The danger is that, let's say, if she has children, if she's left with children, then if the brother marries this woman, that's committing a death penalty. One who marries the sister-in-law is committing a sin of a death penalty if she has children. It's only when she has no children that he has the mitzvah of Yibum. So, mitzvah of Yibum means, well, he's doing it for the sake of the mitzvah. If it's not for the sake of the mitzvah, that means that he's taking his sister-in-law, which is forbidden. It's not that real kavanah. And that means then that this is a forbidden type of relation where the child can be a mamzer, that's for sure. So it's as though, not that it's the sin, of course, even if he marries her for a bad reason, it's still legal, but it's as though he's marrying a forbidden sister-in-law, as though it's an illegal marriage where the child is like a mamzer. So therefore the Gemara says, always select, prefer chalitza, divorce her rather than to marry her. This of course is a machloket to the Gemara. Different rabbis argue about this, and in fact even in Shulchan Aruch too, we find that among the Sfaradim, in Shulchan Aruch, it says that it's permissible to have Yibum. The Ashkenaz law is that it's forbidden for this reason. This is just advice in the Gemara, good advice, even if it's permissible, stay away from it. Second thing is, stay away from battle, stay away from controversies, pursue peace. Always seek to make peace between two Jews, and between yourself and another Jew. Third item is making a vow. A person makes a vow. Let's say that he didn't think clearly, he let a vow escape his lips. Rather than to fulfill that vow, let's say he says tomorrow he's not going to eat. Rather than to fulfill, he made a vow, he said it in the term of a vow, swearing. Rather than to fulfill the vow to show he's not going to break that, better to be matir neder, to go to a chacham, three rabbis, and have this vow removed, rather than to fulfill the vow. Of course, the says, one who makes a vow, it's as though he's building an altar to Abu Dezadeh. One who fulfills a vow, it's as though he is sacrificing to Abu Dezadeh on the altar. But these three items a person should stay away from. But the Yemenis says, Rabbi Yossi makes a statement which the Yemenah tries to analyze. The statement exactly is that if a person says that he has no Torah, then that person does not have Torah. That's the statement. So the Yemenah says, first, let's see. Does Rabbi Yossi mean if a person says he does not want to study Torah at all, he refuses to study Torah, that person has no mitzvah for the study of Torah? There's a shi'ur, a yeshiva, a class, a lesson. He refuses to come to that class because he says he gets no mitzvah for the study of Torah. The Yemenah says it's impossible because that's understood. It's certainly so. No doubt about that. What is he letting us know? He doesn't study Torah. Why should he get mitzvah studying Torah? That's not what he means, probably. What is Rabbi Yossi saying? The Yemenah says it means that a person who studies Torah and says, I'm studying Torah only for the sake of studying Torah, not for the sake of fulfilling the Torah, that person has only Torah. He has only the mitzvah of studying Torah, but not the mitzvah of what's written in the Torah. So the Gemara says, well, that too is understood. If he doesn't do the mitzvah, why should he get credit for it? So surely he has only the mitzvah of studying Torah, no more. The Gemara answers, no, this is what the Yossi said. A person who says, I'm going to study Torah, which is a big mitzvah, Talmud Torah Kedegi Kulam, but I'm not going to fulfill what I learn, I'm going to learn Torah and learn about the Torah, I'm going to fulfill them, that person doesn't even get the mitzvah of studying Torah either. He doesn't even have the mitzvah of studying Torah. Why? Because there's a pasuk which says, v'lamadatem, and then v'asitem, learn and fulfill. Who gets the credit for learning? Only if there is fulfillment later on. But if a person learns with the intention of not fulfilling, then there's no mitzvah for the study of Torah either. The Gemara says, on the other hand, there's another interpretation. If a person says that he's going to learn for the sake of Torah and not to fulfill it, he does get the credit for the mitzvah of Torah. But in what case? If he's not studying, but he's teaching Torah to others, if he himself does not fulfill it, but he's teaching Torah to others, then he gets the mitzvah only for Torah and not for the mitzvot. What's the chidush there? The chidush is that I would think that since he's teaching Torah to others, he's making them fulfill the mitzvot, he should get their credit for their doing the mitzvah. Yehuda says he does not. He gets the mitzvah only for the study of Torah, but not the credit for the mitzvot that others will do through him. What's the reason? After all, we know for a fact, the Gemara says, Mishneh Pirkei Avot, that one who teaches others and makes them religious, makes them do mitzvot, he gets their credit. Why? Because it would be very unfitting, improper to find that in Olam Haba, his students are in Gan Eden and he's in Gehinom. What would that look like? He taught them Torah and they were in Gan Eden, he's in Gehinom. So therefore, a person who teaches others, he will fulfill the mitzvot. It's no such thing as having just the mitzvah of Torah alone. He'll be on the same level with them, at least he'll fulfill the mitzvot. So how can we say here that in this case he gets the mitzvah of Torah alone without the credit for the mitzvot? Secondly, the bigger question is, how come that Acher, who taught Rabbi Meir, according to the Gemara, which says that if one teaches others to do mitzvot, he gets the same credit as them, and it will never happen that his students will be in Gan Eden, he'll be in Gehinom? How come that Meir was in Gan Eden, and Acher's rabbi was in Gehinom? According to that Gemara, it cannot happen. Tosafot answers that this deals with a case where a person was originally religious, he had emunah, faith, and he taught Torah, and then he dropped. That person, because of the mitzvah of teaching others, will have to come back. It's like the Rizal's haftachah's promise. He'll have to come back and do teshuvah because it's not fit. He should be in Gehinom while the students are in Gehinom. But if a person originally himself was a rasha, then he started to learn and teach, that person can fall back and have, in that interim, while he's religious, he can have students who studied Torah and remained religious while he fell back and dropped out. The case of Acher originally was a apikoris. Then he became close, studied Torah, then he fell back again. That's why Acher was able to be in Gehinom while Mimei, the student, was in Gehinom. This is the meaning of Rabbi Yossi, who says that a person can learn Torah, and get credit only for Torah, not mitzvot. Not the mitzvot of others. The Gemara says that a person who was asked questions of law, and this person answers, he has studied Torah, he has learned Shulchan Aruch, but this question that's asked of him is not found clearly in the Shulchan Aruch. So he has to make comparisons, judge, derive from the law of Shulchan Aruch to make comparisons with the case he's confronted with, and arrive at a conclusion, since we find a Shekhinah of something similar, therefore this case would be the same, making comparisons, and as a result of this comparison, it comes out to be wrong, because the laws are so delicate, one fine point could change the whole law. He's wrong, he is guilty. Why? This is speaking about a case of a person who has a rabbi to turn to, and instead of turning to his rabbi for assistance, he judges it by himself, then that person is completely guilty. In fact, the Gemara says that a person, a rabbi himself who is asked questions, should consider himself a judge over whom hangs a sword. Beneath him is Gehinnom. That's how precariously situated he is. Every moment he might fall into Gehinnom by dictating, by coming out, deciding a law wrongly. So he should enjoin other rabbis, discuss the law with other rabbis to arrive at the correct conclusion. Do not take these halachot lightly. Discuss them and arrive at the proper conclusion. Wherever in doubt, not to be ashamed to ask. Even if a person is a graduate, he has smicha, he has the degree of rabbi, not to feel that he's already fit completely, that perfect that he can answer all questions. There are questions that are above him too. Always turn to his superior to find the information that's necessary. The Gemara says that a divorce for a wife is good or bad. Is it a favor for the wife, or is it harmful to her? Is it something she wants, something she considers a zechut, a merit, or is it something that's disliked and considered something that she would not want to take by force? The Gemara says in the case of a dispute, a bitter argument between husband and wife, then the husband gives the wife a divorce, even then, when there's actually a hatred between them, even then it's not considered a zechut, not considered something which is beneficial to her. It's harmful. Why? Because the Reish Lakish said, every woman, without exception, except of course some of the insane ones of now, liberation and so on, every woman without exception, he says, would rather live as a married woman than as a single one. There's nothing more painful, more embarrassing for a woman than to say at an advanced age that she is not married, she's unmarried. The pride with which she can speak to her friends and other women by saying, the word my husband, that is worth everything in a woman's life. What's meant by everything? That even if she has a husband who is no bargain at all, still the fact she can use the word, employ the term my husband, that's worth even having a husband who is bad. The Gemara says, for example, if a woman has a husband who is very tiny, the Gemara is like an ant, small as an ant, a worm, as some wives call their husbands worms, this one is literally small like a worm, then she'll sit among the elite, among the intellectuals, with pride and speak of her husband, though he's that small. Or if her husband is in a business that's very disrespectful, not in a sense illegal, but low type of business, low type of trade, then she'll still be proud to sit outside of this openly among others, hold her head high because this is a husband. Or the ministers, if her husband comes from a family of ill repute, a low type of people, very poor family tree, then she'll still accept him and ask very little in return. Don't provide for me any luxuries, as long as you give me your name. The fact that I am Mrs. is worth more than all the luxuries you can give me. The Gemara says, this is all true, but know that these women are not that good, they're not that stupid. women who have these kind of husbands, one is a worm, the other is a very low type of business, a failure, and a third comes from a very bad family tree, they only take the husband for the title, Mrs., not for the sake of the husband. So these women who commit the worst type of crimes, they go out and commit adultery, and then when they are found to be pregnant, then they use the as a shield, they use the title Mrs. This is the husband. Husband's child, Babi Nan. So it's these that breed mothers they did. In other words, Yunus says the point is that a person in getting married should be very careful in selecting a mate, one that is truly fitting, and above all, where there is an absolute mutual respect and affection between husband and wife. Only then can it be a lasting friendship, a lasting bond, and there can be happiness between both without seeking the outside crimes. The Imam says that if a person dies and we have to seek evidence of his death, proof of his death, you must have witnesses who recognize him and will testify to the fact this person is dead, thereby, for example, freeing his wife to be married to others. Otherwise, she could remain in doubt forever. How do we testify in recognizing a person? Only in the face. You cannot say, I recognize the person's figure is not enough. I recognize them by face. What part of the face is the one that is the most distinguishing feature in a person? The Imam says it's the nose. The nose of a person is the manner in which a person can be best recognized. For example, there was one rabbi who owed money to the leaders of the community. He was very, very poor. He wanted to avoid embarrassment going out among them. If they'd see him, they would approach him on the street, embarrass him, ask him for the money. But he had to go out on the street, had to go to Knis, learn. So he took wax, placed it in his nostrils, and changed the shape of his nostrils, and also a bit on his forehead. There was nothing else to change. Just by changing the shape of his nose and the forehead, this way it was impossible to recognize him. Because the Pasuk says, Hakadat Rehim Antabem. The person is recognized through the face, which means that which is most the most outstanding feature of the face, which is the nose. By changing the shape of the nose, the person cannot be recognized. That's why some people have plastic surgery done on their nose, and they are indistinguishable afterwards. The Gemara says that if a person, again, a man leaves his wife on a trip, and then it is known that his boat, for example, sank, the ship sank, but the body was not found, can that woman remarry? Is she free? The answer is, if we know definitely that he can never come back, positive of his being drowned, then she can remarry. If there's a slight chance of his coming back, then she cannot remarry regardless of how many years passed by. Now how can we tell? In the case of water, this is called Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Sof and Mayim Sheyin Lahem Sof. If the waters have a boundary, there's a limit to the waters. We can go from one end of the water to the next, like a lake, for example. A man is drowned in that lake. Then the woman is free to remarry, because we know if he didn't come out, he must have drowned. Mayim she'ela himself, waters that have no boundary, like a river, a sea, or an ocean, a man is drowned in that water, then she cannot remarry, because we never can tell. There might be tunnels underneath the water. He might come out miles down further in the ocean or river elsewhere, and we cannot be positive that he is alive, that he is dead. Therefore, she cannot remarry. The Gemara says that one rabbi once had a question come before him about a certain river, and it's Rav Shila. And Rav Sheila stated, since the name was lost in that river, his wife may marry. Two chief rabbis, Nadav and Shmuel, Nadav said to Shmuel, let's place this rabbi in Chidim, because he stated that his wife could remarry in the case of a river where there's no end to this river, there's no boundary to it. Shmuel said, before we put him in Chidim, let's first question him. So he called up Sheila, and he asked him, what is the law if a man is lost in waters that have no boundary? He said, the wife cannot marry. So he said to him, what about this water where this case, this man was lost? Was that water with a boundary or without a boundary? So he said, this is water without a boundary. So he asked him, in that case, why did you permit the wife to remarry? So he said, I admit I made a mistake. I didn't tie the two together, I erred there. In other words, this was a case of error. So, of course, the husband never came back. It's understood that we know he died, he drowned, but by law, the wife cannot remarry in such a case.